Before we get into Australian true crime, may I suggest my other podcast, The Nitty Gritty Committee, which this week features comedian and creator of Please Like Me, Josh Thomas.
You know, at the end of my street, there's this huge billboard that says vote no. You just think, oh, they still hate us.
That's The Nitty Gritty Committee, wherever you get your podcasts. On the 29th of April 1996, 21-year-old Lee Ahn Tun was abducted in broad daylight from the front yard of the house he lived in with his mother and siblings. As his neighbours watched on in terror, he was forced into the boot of a car and driven away.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Former homicide detective Jeff Maher worked the case of Lee Ahn Tun's abduction, and it turned out to be one of the most complicated of his career. It required the assistance of police from Hong Kong and various points around Vietnam and China to London and California. And it was all done, would you believe, without the benefit of the internet. Jeff begins by talking us through the first moments of the case from his perspective.
Right, Lee Ahn Tun. Well, I did a Victoria Police Vietnamese language and culture course. But so I did that course, and as a result of that, learned, because at the time it was a Richmond CI, mm-hmm. And had a large population of Vietnamese mm-hmm. there. So I was integrating with the local community. Did that course. That came in good stead for later on, where one of the first cases I was involved in was the kidnapped murder of Lee Ahn Tun. Now, Lee is the surname, Ahn mm-hmm. is the middle Christian name, and Tun is the is the first Christian name. So it's in reverse of what, you know, it's of anglicised name. So anyway, so that particular investigation came about because at the time, there was the Tactical Response Squad and Homicide Squad, and I was at the Homicide Squad at the time, but the Tactical Response Squad got involved because Lee Ahn Tun had been kidnapped in Regal Court in Glen Waverley, and that was in the early 90s.
So how did they know? Were there witnesses to the kidnapping?
There were witnesses that saw the a kidnapping mm-hmm. And Lee Ahn Tun being bundled into a car. Mm-hmm. And then there was one wrote the rego number down of the vehicle. And then there were other, so there was that, and there was also a note. There was a note.
Oh, wow, okay.
Left on the table in the house in Regal Court with basically what had gone on and the ransom demand.
Right.
Which was in Vietnamese, which wasn't discovered until a little time later. So he was grabbed by three other Asian persons or Asian parents in a Camry. I remember the rego number, and that was written down by one of the witnesses. And then we had the kidnapped ransom demand in the house. And there was a bit of, there was a little bit of damage in the house done. And so Tactical Response Squad got involved to obviously recover the hostage. And we, Homicide, got notified because if things turn pear-shaped a little bit later on, we're in a position where we can assist with the investigation or take it over.
So what was the demand, by the way, the ransom demand?
It was $400,000 in a different bank accounts. The front of the house was actually a cap that was dropped on the ground as well, which would become very important later on because the cap was a Marlboro cap, mm-hmm. And that cap was had the Marlboro man on the horse on it, and it was only sold in outlets that sold in America cartons of Marlboro cigarettes at points of departure. Oh. You get a free Marlboro cap. So once again, I was the scene sergeant in charge of the crew. The informant on this matter was Stephen Tregard, who's now left the job and pursuing things in private industry, doing pretty well. A very, very fine detective, but he was the primary investigator. So we actually, when the body of Leon Tun was discovered, we eventually then formed a task force. So I suppose it went like this, is that he was kidnapped, he was held a ransom, there was negotiation, and in fact I believe that he'd been probably murdered in a short period after he'd been contact held and then murdered, and then his body was located in a large drain down towards the old AFL park. There's a big spoon drain, huge spoon drain out the back of AFL Park there, and some kids riding home from school on their bikes discovered his body, and they ended up contacting police. Police turned up, search and rescue turned up and got the body out. And
what was the time frame between kidnap and finding Tun's body?
Might have been a month or so. His body was located. Was discovered he'd been shot to the head, and then the investigation formed a task force, which was a combination of the tactical response squad, the homicide squad, and other detectives that we could get in, and that was Task Force or Operation Paddy, PATTI, and that was the investigation in the kidnap murder of Leon Tun. So as a result of that, we were able to locate a house in Clayton that we believe he'd been held in.
Wow. How?
Because he'd obviously been held somewhere.
Yeah.
And we canvassed every single state agent in that area that we could, basically in the particular area we thought would be where we need to look. And as a result of that, we were able to discover that we located a house where he'd been held.
That's amazing work to be able to do that.
Were you looking for, like, Vietnamese tenants? Or
Vietnamese tenants, and we located a number of those, but we were able to narrow it right down. When we investigated it, we found that the curtains had been closed up, the closed pegs, mm-hmm. and we actually found a Melways in there, which we've all got navigators now.
Yeah.
But they're on Melways, and the Melways had the in the page that was appropriate to Regal Court, mm-hmm. had Regal Court circled.
Oh, right. So the Melways has helped solve quite a few crimes.
Hey, did his family know why he'd been kidnapped? Way back in the very beginning when they first called the police, did they know why their son, brother, had been kidnapped?
There were a couple of hypotheses in relation to why he'd been kidnapped, but really we could never, ever determine the exact reason why.
Really?
It's a very middle class, Glen Waverley, quiet, very middle class.
Correct.
It's not like you get a kidnapping every day there.
His mother was an importer-exporter of goods. She got involved in this particular case, and there were some other people involved, which I won't go into, that she actually knew. Mm-hmm. And when we eventually caught the main crook, whose name was Trung Phuc, which is T-R-U-O-N-G,
mm-hmm.
and Phuc as in P-H-U-C.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And he was eventually extradited from England. I'll go into that in a minute. But there were other people out here involved. There was one prosecuted but walked away from it.
Wow. So the family is calling the police and saying our son's been kidnapped but we don't know why.
Correct.
And then some time later his body is found in the drain. And so now it's your problem.
So we've found the hat, we've found the note.
Oh, that's right, yep.
We've found the body, found a shot to the head, and then we found the premises had been held at, and then there was some negotiation. We also were able to identify through phone records again the contact we were having overseas, and we had this contact. The kidnappers were basically calling from Hong Kong, which was under British rule at the time. And also when we eventually caught up with all the players, and there were a number of other players from other countries that came over. So the vehicle was belonged to some relatives out here that Truong Phuc had, but were never charged. And the vehicle's located, dumped down at Seaford. A huge forensic examination was done of the vehicle, and the vehicle had been comprehensively cleaned, like absolutely every nut and bolt had been cleaned and sanitised in the vehicle, so we got no joy out of that car. And we eventually pursued who we thought to be the main offender, who was Truong Phuc, living in Hong Kong. And a whole heap of evidence pointed towards him, and particularly phone records. So we executed warrants over in Hong Kong using the Organised Crime and Triad Bureau at the time, which was part of their crime squads over there. And as a result of that raid, we found the – and I'm trying to simplify this because it was a fairly complex
case.
Sounds
very complicated.
But we found the fax machine – with the fax in it that had faxed the ransom note through here to Melbourne.
Oh, my God.
And we found...
To go to all the trouble, by the way, of forensically cleaning the car and leave the fax in the machine.
Fax in the machine in Hong Kong. And at the property we were led to, where their detectives from the, as I said, Organised Crime and Trade Bureau went to. And then we found also other bits and pieces in there. We found a book with some details of a motel that our kidnappers had stayed at in Sydney. That was noted. We also found a photograph that basically had a number of the players photographed at a restaurant as well. I travelled to Hong Kong with another detective, and we spent a couple of weeks there, and we interviewed and took statements on from about 50 witnesses. And brought back some exhibits from over in Hong Kong. There were other people went to, we had detectives from Oakland PD in America.
Wow, America's involved now as well.
So what happened was we've got the main offender, Truong Phuc, who's doing
what? Did you meet him, by the way, when you were in Hong Kong?
No.
Okay.
No, I went over there before we arrested him.
Okay.
He, at the time, had fled there and he was in England.
Right.
So kidnapping occurs in Waverley.
Yep.
Body found in AFL, near AFL Park.
Yeah.
House in Clayton was where he was held. And then we've got vehicle found in Seaford.
Hat from America.
And then we've got the hat from America found out the front, and then we have the 50 statements and the evidence in Hong Kong, the facts and all the rest of it. We then determined that there were two guys that came out from America, two Vietnamese Americans flew out from there, who were collected by another Vietnamese person here from Sydney, and they drove back down. From Sydney, we were able to get CCTV up there. We were able to get they got a parking ticket. We were able to get the parking ticket details. And they were intercepted by the New South Wales Highway Patrol coming back and gave their proper names as well. Wow. So we had a
– had some help.
We had some help, but at the end of the day, we pieced it all together. We had Detective Bing Hoylo from the Oakland PD get us some DNA samples from potential crooks over there. He brought that DNA sample out. They were compared with the sweat that we got off the hat that we found in the drive, and basically it matched the DNA on the hat.
That's amazing.
We got manifest details from America, using the AFP counterparts over there. They got some manifest details.
From the airlines?
From the airlines, yeah. And also purchase records of purchasing cigarettes.
All right. And you got the cap.
Got the cap. And the three of them involved wore the cap.
Oh.
So eventually what occurred was we had enough of a brief. As I said, Steve Dricard did a fantastic job, put the brief together. We had enough to arrest and extradite Truong Phuc from England. He was located by Detective Harry Demko, who was New Scotland Yard extradition squad. They were able to find him over there. He was arrested, brought before the court, and eventually extradited back to Australia to face trial here over the kidnap murder of Leon Tun.
Wow. Did you meet him then?
Yes, when he was back out here, obviously, at trial, and met him then.
So by this stage, you've known this name and you've been chasing this character around the world. What, tell us about the first time you laid eyes on Truong Phuc. You finally got to meet him and see him. Who is this bloke?
Well, he was a sort of, once again, he was sort of a fairly slick-looking guy.
I can remember when Steve Dricard brought him back from the States and he had a nice watch on and he wanted to make sure that the watch didn't get damaged by the handcuffs and so on and so forth. So he's a bit of a slick operator.
I think he's got a few more problems than that, basically.
Yeah, well, he got out here and, as I said, he was grabbed and arrested. Now, in the meantime, we've got him out here for trial, but we also then tried to extradite one of the players that had gone back to America, one of the kidnappers.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we ran a series of hearings over in America and we lost the extradition to get him back. The other brother went to Vietnam and he unfortunately got caught with a large amount of heroin.
All right. You don't say.
So yeah. Steve Dricard flew over and interviewed him over there and he was able to shed some light on what we'd learned. It was pretty spot on, but he was convicted and executed over there. Oh, so he never came back.
Wow!
The other one is still in the United States that we haven't been able to get back.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, we find out exactly how police shared reams of information across the world before the internet existed in any meaningful way. Get ready to relive the glory days of the fax machine, but first, Jeff tells us about the trial of the man who masterminded the kidnapping and murder of Lee An Trun from half a world away, Truong Phuc.
So Truong Phuc's trial here went a substantial period of time. We had, police officers and witnesses on video link from Hong Kong and from other parts of the world, and the whole thing came together and he was convicted of the kidnap murder.
Wow, and which he didn't carry out himself, but the hypothesis is sent these fellows from America to carry out.
Yep.
But he was convicted.
Convicted.
Truong Phuc.
Absolutely.
For murder.
And for kidnapping.
Oh, okay.
Now, as you can see with the hitman scenarios now, the person who gets the hitman is also probably more liable than the hitman.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's it's the same sort of scenario.
Mm.
So, yeah, he was convicted and, appealed. We went to the High Court again on that particular and basically related to the law of speciality and extradition law and whether he'd been correctly extradited from England. And, in fact, the High Court gave a decision that he was and the conviction stood and so on and so forth. But, yeah, pretty interesting job that you've got phone records involved, you've got witnesses seeing cars, rego numbers being written down, DNA on a cap that was really only sold at a certain location.
It's incredible.
Detectives travelled, I think, went to Hong Kong a couple of times, travelled to England to extradite him back. There was evidence gathered there.
It's an incredible example of working internationally and nationally with other police forces. Like, I don't know if I've heard of another case where there's so many different
places. It was really interesting because this occurred prior to emails.
So how does that work?
I'm getting goosebumps thinking about this.
I actually kind of sometimes long for those days. Like,
are you waiting up till the middle of the night to call Bing in Oakland to ask them a favour?
Well, can I tell you that we would, I think there was one or two email addresses for VicPol, and we didn't really have access to them. So what we had to do was fax documents. Yeah. So I can remember being at 412 St Kilda Road, which is now gone, and everyone's based at 313 Spencer Street, but 412 St Kilda Road. And I remember in the middle of the night there faxing documents off, like I remember 74-page document off to the States, and it had a jam about page 31 or 33, and you'd have to do it all again. And it was very frustrating. Very frustrating. But look, at the end of the day, it worked pretty well. It is from coming from that sort of technology now to what we've got now, it changed us dramatically, dramatically, that you would get seen volumes of requests and evidence, you know, at the touch of a button over to different countries.
Trump must have been completely shocked at his own incarceration in the end, because he wasn't there. He didn't participate in the crimes himself. He's hired people from another country, flown them in. He must have been completely shocked that you were able to piece all of this together, do you think?
Yeah, I think he was a bit shocked that he was arrested and extradited.
Yes.
But, you know, the extradition squad that brought New Scotland Yard did an outstanding job locating, you know, surveilled him, locked him down to a premises, grabbed him and then held him until we were able to get over there for the extradition process.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he was a bit flabbergasted, but even more flabbergasted that, you know, he got convicted out here. He got a substantial, my recollection, he got life with 25 or a bit more on the bottom.
He must have had a lot of money as well, so he must have had great legal representation and all that.
Well, you know, it was, yes. I agree with you there, but there was also that, you know, he had some decent connection because he obviously had connections with drug trafficking, heroin trafficking. So there was a lot more tentacles to this particular job that
Broadly speaking, it had something to do with drugs, the kidnapping.
Don't know, but we know that Trung Phuc was, you know, a drug trafficker, commercial quantity drug trafficker. So, but the hypothesis in relation to why he was kidnapped, we still don't know. But he'd come up on a number of other jobs, AFP jobs as well. So,
It's known to police.
So the interesting thing was, you know, getting people coming out from the States, couple being involved here, and also him being in Hong Kong and then heading over to England, like, it really did give the big international flavour. And to have that sort of time delay, no emails, no FaceTime, no Skype,
No scanning documents and emailing them on your phone.
And if you do, no scanning and putting them on PDFs.
It was all single page.
You know, it was a learning curve.
Is he still in prison?
My understanding is there's an exchange of prisoners program. There was talk about him getting on the exchange of prisoners program where he'd be sent over to be close. And I think it's quite an often done thing that they, after a period of time here, they exchange with different. We've got treaties with different countries, so
happens more than you think.
There was one other guy involved in this. His name was. And he was one of the players with Trung Phuc, and he ended up, we knew he was about, but the later in the investigation we discovered that we were trying to locate him, and we had an Interpol red notice, we call that. We're trying to find him. And
so was he in Australia or you thought
No, we didn't know where he was. Okay. He'd never come out here, but we knew he was hanging around, you know, the Southeast Asia area. But we ended up getting contact from basically via the Chinese or Vietnamese governor, I can't remember, Hong Kong, might have been Hong Kong, saying basically that he'd been arrested over in mainland China for commercial drug trafficking, and if you wanted to get over and speak to him, better get over quick.
Mm-hmm. Did you?
No, we never made it over there. He was arrested tried, convicted and executed there as well. So
I think they go pretty quickly in China.
Yeah, so no, we never got to speak to him. Yeah. So, but look, good. And, you know, to have that cat, which was which was pretty interesting to find the three DNAs.
And again, now that you mention pre-internet, I'm wondering, how do you even find out that it's only for sale at airports in America if you buy Marlboros? Because you can't Google it.
Shane Castles with the AFP was the liaison officer over there at the time, and he did a lot of good running around for us over there and a lot of work at the airport and a lot of work to locate the crooks that we're looking for over there.
Some good investigating.
Oh, yeah.
And absolutely fantastic, Shane Castles, good man. And then, we, you know, to have Bing Hoilo basically to get us the DNA samples and then bring them over in a Esky.
Did he really?
You know, and he brought him over in an Esky. We've got this photograph of Steve Tricard, Sol Solomon, who's another good homicide detective there, and they're standing at coming off the gateway of the aircraft with Bing Hoilo holding the Esky because he wasn't going to lose continuity with it. Yeah, and that was a bit. Bit funny, but
that's brilliant.
Yeah,
to have a lot of help from. How did you get around the language barrier? Like, did you get interpreters helping you? I just seem to think back when this was all happening, you used to hear about the triads a lot more. I don't know if they've gone quiet in crime, but you know, was there a lot of interpreters?
We were working with in Hong Kong, myself and Paul Sheridan, working with the Organised Crime and Triad Bureau. So that sort of puts it in the flavour. Yeah. We used, you know, English interpreters over there to get us back to English for us to take the statements. And then we used over here, obviously, for any product that we had. Over here that we used, that we needed to get, translated. We had Vietnamese, you know, through, I think it's, the accredited interpreters. And, a substantial amount of interpreting over here that we had to get done. So, it was sort of pretty laborious because, you know, it was a long haul.
Is it still a big thing here? I remember the Asian Crime Squad was an important squad here in Melbourne. Yep. And then we heard in a previous episode that now the Middle Eastern Crime Squad is sort of bigger. And is the Asian Crime Squad still a thing?
There's, you know, Vic Pol's obviously got the gangs division within crime. But at the time, you know, there was a fairly substantial market through Hong Kong and those sorts of areas in heroin trafficking. Mm-hmm. You know, and there was areas in Sydney that these people were involved in as well, Cabramatta and a few other areas up there that they were in. But, there was a flavour of heroin trafficking and importing and exporting and all the rest of it. But, you know, it was a bit of an eye-opener because of the quantities that, you know, we were seeing that related to this particular investigation were, you know, pretty gobsmacking. So
this is a fascinating case. It's actually one of – it's like I didn't immediately know it.
No.
I was actually living overseas as well. That's probably part of the reason. But just the complexity of it is incredible.
The investigation's incredible, and I can't get over the fact that you never established – why?
There was an unknown, but obviously they did undertake the kidnapping and, you know.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't just
there
targeted.
Was a dead
randomly.
Ode or what we don't know. But at the end of the day, it was. But it's also, you know, the phone record technology at that point in time, it's just leaps and bounds since, you know.
Oh, now it's pings off towers.
Everything, you know, everyone knows it.
Everyone leaves a digital footprint.
Yes.
I'm always fascinated by this. So the investigation you had to do pre all this technology we have is amazing. It obviously helps these days a lot more, but is it making us a bit lazier, like a bit dumber? I don't know.
You really say to the new detectives, you say to them, it's a confession or CCTV is a good start to an investigation, but it doesn't finish it.
Okay.
It
so
does
still
not
got to
finish
do the fundamentals.
It. You don't think you've got to lay down as air because that's when you come unstuck.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next Thursday with another instalment.